This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about therapy with Alison Dineen. And because we record these, obviously, before I type out the titles for them, you may see that it says counselling. And actually, that was the first thing I wanted to talk about. So here in the UK, it's more commonly referred to as counselling. In the US, it's more commonly referred to as therapy. And I've got a definition, actually, which might partly illuminate why some of that difference is there. So this is just a definition for the word therapy in general. The treatment of someone with mental or physical illness without the use of drugs or operations. And I think that might highlight why, for me personally, counselling can feel like the more specific word, because therapy can, of course, include things like physiotherapy, which is for physical health conditions. There's also, interestingly, a bit of a trend where people might go more on one word or the other, depending on the specialism they trained in. So if you're a hypnotherapist, I wonder if part of the reason I hear more hypnotherapists referring to their work as therapy is because it's, of course, in the name. Whereas if you did a degree in person-centered counselling, counselling's in your degree, and so you might be more biased towards that word. But yeah, you know me, I'm very interested in language. Is this making sense, Danielle?
Absolutely, I agree with you. You know, we both are, really.
I think it's just a broader word. Because I think that's part of the reason why I think of a physiotherapist, you know, because I just think of other types of roles that involve the word therapy. And it does tend to be a bit broader.
We are so pro-therapy and counselling, aren't we? And I just feel like we don't necessarily need to wait until there's an issue or we've had a real problem. I think when we think about positive mental health, that anybody, if it was available to us all without a cost and, you know, there was more accessibility, we all have ups and downs. And it's great to have somebody that you can talk to that actually is skilled and that understands how to, you know, help you reflect and to support you through that time. It doesn't always have to be in a setting that's really specific, but it can help to be in that moment where there aren't intrusions and we haven't got phones going and we're really focused and paying attention in that moment together to work through something. And I think it's just definitely something that we all would benefit from.
No, absolutely. And you're right, it's something that we really advocate for. But I think you might have really hit on something there, which is perhaps a big difference between why some people might have a preference for one word or the other. So for me, you'll often hear, you know, even if it's an American guest and they're talking about therapy, my questions will often include the word counselling. That's the one I tend to use. But I also wonder if there's a stigma element as well, that sometimes therapy, because it's a broader word, it can feel easier or it can feel less stigmatized to go get it. In the same way, you know, you wouldn't think of stigma of like aromatherapy or muscle therapy as like a type of massage, right? And so perhaps because it's a broader word, it feels safer. In the same way, I'm very funny about when the term well-being works with that big broad term, and when mental health or mental illness, more specific terms, should be used. And I think the listeners will have recognised that in certain podcasts they may have come across. There's a distinction between wellness podcasts that tend to cover a broader range of topics, whereas we're very specific about everything relating back to mental health. And so we're branded as a health podcast as opposed to wellbeing. But it is interesting for us having guests from so commonly here and in the States, that kind of contrast. And I think you're right that it is less stigmatized to go and get this kind of support in the US. It's something that's both more common, but also seen as more common and more normalized. So someone would go maybe if they want to work on themselves as like a personal development thing. It's not seen only as there's something wrong with you. And I think that's the kind of stereotyping that can be very damaging here. And so I think that's one of the challenges, but it is getting a lot more common that people get this kind of support, reach out for this kind of support in this country. And so we've got some stats from the NHS to highlight that. So for the year 2019 through to 2020, 1.6 million referrals were made for people to get talking therapy. And we have a wonderful tool here called IAPT, which stands for Improving Access to Psychological Therapies, which has been part of that number growing over the years, where people can now self-refer for therapy. And this number is a combination of those self-referrals and referrals via your GP or other services. And so many more people are reaching out for that support and is being met well in most cases as well. And so 87.4% of those referrals led to someone starting treatment within 6 weeks, which is really brilliant. That number is 2% down on the previous year, but still very high. And still, as usual, one of the very impressive things about our NHS. So it's nice to have some positive stats. It is worth noting that, of course, that is for the year leading up to when the pandemic started. And so it would be, I'm sure, a whole different set of stats when we see them later this year for the last year.
Absolutely. But yeah, what a fantastic statistic, though, to be able to put in there. And, you know, we've got to take the opportunity, I guess, to big up our NHS, because they're absolutely fantastic. And that is a great statistic that we are connecting, you know, and we know that some people in crisis, and there is opportunities for those to connect sooner if you really are in crisis. But to know that you can connect even when you're not, within 6 weeks, is fantastic.
It's very impressive. Of course, there are people that fall outside of that, and it is quite disproportionate depending on what kind of service you're looking for. So from what I read up about it, that's my main concern at this point with access to counselling, is when you need something specialised. So often the waiting times are massive for that. So something like CBT, which is the most common form given under these services, whereas something like DBT, which is similar but is more commonly recommended for people with borderline personality disorder, the waiting list for that can be massive in some areas. And so that's where the stats don't look as rosy. And when oftentimes people end up going to private services or charity services to fill those gaps. So definitely there's more work to be done. But what is definitely in place is that there are wonderful counsellors all over the country doing incredible work, many of whom, in the challenging circumstances of connecting to somebody in this intimate and vital way over Zoom, which, as we know, even ourselves today, having some connection issues just trying to record this intro, it's challenging. So currently Danielle's video is turned off because it was seeming to slow down the connection.
I know, I can see you, but you can't see me. It's like you're really talking to me, and I know, bless you, you can't even see me. But I think that's a really valid point to make at the end of this. You know, thank you again to all the amazing counsellors and therapists that we've got working so hard throughout this whole time. And the fact that they've had to adapt and move online, I know, you know, must be extremely challenging, because there's that, you know, whole element of not being able to, you know, switch off and leave the office and come home, because a lot of them and colleagues that I know are working from home as counsellors. And we know that people do it online anyway. Even before the pandemic, you could have a session online, but a lot of work is done, you know, in a therapeutic environment. But at least we're still able to have those conversations and those sessions. So thanks to Zoom and Teams and all the other platforms. But yeah, so yeah, it's keep up the good work. And we really do advocate therapy and counselling. So definitely something for people to look into if it's a path that they've not gone down before.
Absolutely. And you were saying a very serious point, and in my head I was thinking, it really sounds like we could be sponsored by Zoom, but we're not. Which is very grateful, even though connection problems can exist on any platform. And so we should mention, when thanking wonderful counsellors here, that there are counsellors that are wonderful all over the world, including today's guest, Alison Deneen, who is best known for her Instagram account called Notes from Your Therapist, which is hugely popular. We'll mention that a little bit in the episode, and has gone on to write a book of the same name. And she's someone that, for me, really sums up so many of the lovely, empowering aspects that so many counsellors share. You know, someone really warm, someone so easy to talk to, someone that's really encouraging and is a good listener, even when she's the guest and, you know, I'm there primarily to listen to her. I really felt the active listening whenever it is I asked her a question. So yeah. I really enjoyed getting to chat to her and meeting the woman behind what is a really cool Instagram account that I follow, where I get to see these little introspective quotes to mention last week's theme. So yeah, so delighted to get this guest on.
She was fantastic, wasn't she?
Absolutely. We connected to her straight away. So if anything happens to my counsellor, I think I know who I might be.
She was brilliant because she was so open, you know, and I think that's, and, you know, she really talked about the fact that, you know, you connect with some people and some people you just don't, even in, you know, the therapeutic world. I think it's really important to recognise that as well. You know, some people that you just will connect with and some you won't. And actually, Bob, I don't know if you want to or Pete edit in, but I do think it's worth a mention of that, because you've always been quite strong about that as well, Bobby, in terms of, you know, finding somebody that suits you and how important that is and that connects with you in whatever way that might be. And I think we sometimes forget that when we might, you know, have a counsellor and think, oh, it's not worked, that you recognise yourself in some aspects in your counsellor or your therapist, then that's okay to go and seek that. I think that's really important.
And I think for me, part of why that's so important is that so often people go into the beginning of a therapeutic relationship feeling quite disempowered. You know, they may have some insecurities about getting the help. They may be feeling some of the internalised stigma of, I'm not worth the help. And so often you can feel quite disempowered at the start of that. But it is really important, if that relationship isn't working for you, there will be somebody that will fit better. And so I guess if no one else is going to say it, we're always going to be here to say, you are enough. You deserve the help. You deserve the right help and the best help. And it's out there. And there's so many options. So many options these days for getting that. So we'll discuss that all in a lot more depth with today's guest. So let's get into that interview with Alison in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Alison Deneen, and my earliest experience, I suppose, with mental health issues would be, although I didn't think of it in those terms, was probably my whole childhood. My family was pretty dysfunctional and struggling with a lot of issues that now I look back and see as, you know, mental health struggles. But they were my life. They were just like my normal family life. I didn't know anything different. And things just kind of got worse, I suppose. I got more depressed about anything changing. I just tried to muddle my way through my family life and teenage years until I could escape, basically, till I could move out and be on my own. And I went off to college and thought that would be like freedom and everything would be so much better. And that's when like real depression kind of hit, I think, in that first year of college.
Do you mind sharing a little bit of what kind of pressures you were facing at home?
I suppose if I had to make it simple, there were issues of parental depression, substance abuse, addiction, some violence, definitely just very, very unhappy, struggling, you know, adults that just didn't have a lot of support for themselves. And just, it just got handed down to children. So that's how I would describe it.
And when you look back, do you feel there's a link for you in terms of the parental figures around you having depression or symptoms of it, and then that being the direction in which your mental ill health went?
Oh, definitely. I think that when I think back on it, the burden fell on us, the kids. There were five of us. You know, we all found different ways to help our parents be okay, because that's what kids do. You know, you need your parents to be kind of stable. So whatever you have to do, whether that's like shut down your own feelings or be super helpful or be their confidant or take their abuse or whatever it is to make the family unit feel okay and somewhat safe, is I think what kids do. And so it struck us all in different ways, I think, all five of us kids in my family.
Mm. And that really rings true to a lot of my experience as well, as being a parentified child. And I often describe it to people as being like you're filling the gaps in the parenting. And whilst at the time it can be quite practical and help you to cope and survive challenging experiences, often then we look back in hindsight and we realise how fast we grew up in certain ways at a time when it was inappropriate for us to maybe be doing the amount of parenting or having emotional responsibilities from such a young age.
Definitely. And I think the repercussions on adulthood are really profound. You know, no one tells you when you're 18 and you leave home that you don't have to do that particular coping strategy anymore with other people. So whatever we did as kids, we usually just keep doing it in our adult relationships. So if our job was to like cheer someone up and not have any needs of our own, we just keep doing that because that's what our skill set is. Like, we're really good at it usually, whatever it is. We're really good at it and we've had a lot of practice. So no one really tells us, you know, you don't have to do that anymore. I think what I found during that period of a year after leaving home was, you know, there was a lot of loneliness. I was in a brand new world and I didn't know a lot of people, made a few friends, but, you know, I didn't have any longstanding friends or people I felt very connected to. When I think about it, what actually happened is I think the grief of my entire childhood just like hit me like a wall at that point. And I hadn't sorted through it all, but I think it was just catching up with me what I'd had to do to make it through. I think I felt a lot of loss and grief, but also very alone because I didn't know how to go forward. I didn't really know what it was going to look like in the future.
Right. And that's so fascinating to me because on one hand, you were in an environment where maybe for the first time, you could be the priority for once. And so that should have been really empowering. But because you'd got so used to holding up other people and fitting into a maybe tightly wound, I might describe it, family dynamic, then perhaps instead you felt a bit directionless because it's like, okay, well, I'm not used to prioritizing me. I don't know how to do that. And instead, I've got all this stuff that was going on with me that I was pushing down and prioritizing other people. And now there's no one to distract me.
That's a great way of putting it, Bobby. I think you don't really get a chance to know yourself when you're busy taking care of other people. And so I think it just hit me that I didn't know a lot of things. I didn't know enough about who I was or how I felt or what I wanted in life. There was a lot of information missing because I hadn't had a chance to focus on just being a kid growing up and, you know, exploring the world and what I might like. Yeah, I love how you said that you would think theoretically it'd be like, yay, freedom. I can suddenly focus on myself. But there's a way that that also feels really dangerous. If your worth was in taking care of other people, it can feel really like, do you know what I mean?
You didn't have the self-worth to think it's okay to look after me. And my worth is in looking after others. And that can feel very actually against who you are and against your identity.
Yes, it felt selfish and just confusing. And maybe that I would alienate other people, you know, if I were thinking about myself and my journey in life and what I wanted.
For sure. And so did you find then that delayed for you getting support as your depression deepened?
Yeah, I didn't really. So this was before there was a lot of therapy. I'm older than you. So, you know, you just didn't hear much about people going to therapy. And I think what happened is that one of my college roommates said, you might want to talk to someone here. They have counselors at the university that you could talk to. And I was kind of excited, but scared. It felt very also wrong. Again, there was another thing from growing up. It felt wrong to need help. It felt wrong to want to just tell someone I was struggling. Very confusing is all I can describe it.
And do you think part of that was maybe that if you had voiced certain needs in your home environment, there would have been negative reaction or repercussions to that?
Oh, definitely. Yes. Kids weren't allowed to have any problems. You know, it was all about these overwhelming, really big, scary adult emotions. So there was no way I was going to say, like, this teacher is mean to me or I'm having a hard time in this class, because that would have just totally been shamed or minimized in a kid. Oh, like, your little kid problems are just irrelevant, I think, is the way it would have been seen.
Right. And of course, as a young person, you don't know any better. So you believe that. You don't have the context of a big part of them saying that is because they're not coping with their own issues. And so they can't even find the space in their brain to relate to somebody else's because they're so full of all their own issues.
Yeah. And I also think as we're talking, Bobby, I realize too that as crazy and destructive as they might be, I think most kids still love their parents. And I felt a lot of shame about the idea of talking about struggling, because that would have gotten them in trouble, or maybe I would have gotten in trouble for saying that I needed help or something like that. But they often say like kids won't do anything because they don't want to risk shaking up the family or something bad happening to their parents. It's just so unknown. It's easier to just kind of get good at tolerating everything that you have to.
I think also children from a young age can tell delicacy. Even if they don't fully understand a family dynamic, they can tell if it's delicate. And so there is that pressure to not poke the wrong thing, not ask the wrong question. And so without even understanding why, you can build up a whole list of topics in your head that we can't talk about, that I can't raise.
That is so nails it. Kids are so sensitive. No one has to tell them, we don't talk about this. So much is unspoken in their high sensitivity, their high level of sensitivity. They just know exactly right. You know, they're really good at scanning the environment for safety, because that's their main job, is to stay safe.
And that's very much their whole world at certain points in your childhood. Keeping that family dynamic feeling safe for you is your existence.
Yeah, even if it's not objectively safe, the familiarity of what you know is safe.
I think that's a really good point. And that really, I think, helps frame why so often people can get in these situations, including right into their adulthood, that are unsafe, but maybe are familiar. And so the familiarity of, let's say you date somebody that has similarities with an abusive parent, there's something ironically that feels safe around this familiar danger.
Yes, because you know how to manage that. You know exactly what to do with those same familiar patterns that you remember that you got good at managing as a kid.
And then it becomes really difficult because there's the love element as well. You know, so you're saying about loving your parents. And so then if you come across people that are similar to them, you can easily paint that as they're a loving person, because you spent so much time thinking of the loving people you grew up with, even if sometimes they do things that we wouldn't think of as loving.
Isn't that so true? I think that you're right about that too. And it makes me think about how confusing love gets. What your childhood looks like just gets all intertwined with what love is. Like, this is what love is helping someone avoid ever getting angry or shutting down your own feelings because that will make someone angry or depressed or overwhelmed. You know, whatever you had to do was done out of love, and it just gets all twined together. Like, that's what a loving person does, is helps other people manage their feelings.
Yeah. And that sounds very much like what you were doing. You'd learned that love was very much about you actively looking after people. And in doing so, that was a lot of where your value was. And so then somebody suggests to you, you know, maybe it's time for you to speak to somebody. There's clearly stuff going on for you. So was there a point then where you were able to rationalize, it is okay for me to go see a counselor? Or did it take maybe things getting worse to tip that point?
I think it was just so bad at that point, Bobby. I just really didn't know what was going to happen next. I didn't feel like I was failing out of school. I didn't know what was going to happen next. So I felt like I had no way out. So I did go this one time. And it's kind of interesting that I even went back, but I went this one time and I saw a therapist at the school that I didn't feel really comfortable with. He wasn't very friendly or warm or approachable. It felt like I couldn't figure him out and what he wanted from me, basically. That probably, now that I'm talking about it, triggered my childhood, right? Because I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do.
Yeah, well, it was still you trying to frame your worth in that environment as how do I make this adult happy?
Right, exactly. And he didn't offer much up. And I think about him now, and I think about this kind of old school of therapy where the therapist was kind of a blank slate and they just asked questions and, well, how does that make you feel? And how does that make you feel? And it just felt like the person wasn't that accessible and I just didn't go back. It just felt so uncomfortable. I didn't go back until later in the year when it was almost time to leave school. One of my friends at school said, you should come see my therapist. You should go see her one time. And I did. I don't know why I did. I just was so out of ideas at that point and just so depressed. I went to see her and that was a completely different experience. She asked me about my childhood. She asked me a lot of details. She was very warm and approachable. And I still remember the moment, I think, when maybe my life kind of changed in this moment. I remember getting up the courage to tell her about the fact that my mother had died when I was little and what had happened after that. She got tears in her eyes and she said something to the effect of, I'm so sorry that ever happened to you. It was like something inside of me just melted that had been like frozen, I think, somehow. I didn't really have a chance to go back to see her, just circumstances and things changed. But in that moment, I've never forgotten her because what I would say about that now from, you know, being older and being a therapist is I needed someone to be accessible. I needed someone that I could have an emotional impact on instead of someone just like my childhood that I could have no emotional impact on. So there was a way that first therapeutic experience just kind of felt like the same thing, someone who had no responsiveness to what I was feeling. I don't know if that makes sense, but they were like night and day experiences.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it sounds like she was really responding to you in a way that you weren't used to. It sounds incredibly validating because I wonder with your mother passing, was there a point prior to that where anybody actually acknowledged how tough that would have been for you? And it wasn't about them or it wasn't that's tough, but actually just sat in the feeling and validated that that is really tough. And you do get to be sad.
No, that had never happened one time in my life. We were not allowed to talk about my mother's death. We were never to talk about it again. And nobody told us that. It was just so clearly forbidden. And so that was confusing as a little kid. I didn't know why, but I just went with the rules about that. And yeah, that would have been a really shameful thing to talk about. It must have come up in some way that I got the idea about that. Oh, I know. Sometimes we would run into some acquaintance or something, and they would say, oh, you look just like your mother. And the whole emotional, like that would just unleash a lot of anger. And I just knew that was a really scary thing if someone ever said that. I both desperately wanted to hear more, but I was terrified that I was going to be in so much trouble. Like I had invited that. Actually, my father was thrown into a terrible depression himself. He right. never grieved my mom. They were really young and he loved her and he was shut down, you know, from processing that too. It was that time when you just got on with life, right? You didn't talk about it. You just kind of got on with things. And what happened to him was he got shut down and depressed and never really talked about it and just kind of developed this happy-go-lucky facade. So I just desperately wanted to keep him happy. So I would never have brought it up with him because I could see how desperately he was just trying to hang on by, you know, being cheerful and happy about everything. And it was really that he remarried and it was really my stepmother that was not happy with her life, not happy with this, with her own feeling kind of trapped in this unhappy marriage. And So he was the sort of depressed one, and my stepmother was the more like volatile, enraged one. So it was kind of a minefield for us kids.
Yeah, no, I can see that, and definitely not an environment you'd really want to have any emotion. You know, I think in that situation, I might even feel quite nervous being happy, because it's just any emotion could be a risk.
That is so true. I hadn't thought about that as much. Yes, you're so right. It would have been really, really bad to be happy as well.
And so then you're spending so many years shrinking yourself down, really, you know, not trying to cause any stir, shrinking your emotions down. You're only really then relevant if you're propping up an adult figure you live with. And so in a way, whilst it's not easy to do cause and effect with mental health, it does kind of make sense to me, at least as an outsider, that depression perhaps fits that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. The kind of the closing down, the shutting down, the pulling your emotions and really your hope shrinking into you.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I think it felt like just really, I felt really numb a lot. Yes, like you described it, there are very minimal amount of feelings it was okay to express. Yeah, so it was just, I think of it as just this kind of shut down, kind of trying to survive, minimizing myself, like minimizing my being, anything that was specific to being about me as a individual or a person.
And then we get the contrast to the therapeutic environment, which is, of course, very led by the client. And you're getting this validation of someone really responding to your emotions in a way you weren't used to. So how did things go after that experience?
Well, at some point in the conversation, she asked me something else I'd never been asked before. And that was, I was talking to her about really struggling in school. And she said, well, what do you want to do? And I hadn't expected that question. And without thinking, I just said, well, I want to just backpack around Europe for a year. So I did. I dropped out of college and that's what I did for the next 6 to 8 months. And it was an amazing experience, but I also can see that it was a bit of a distraction because I think it was a lot, you know, you just have this one conversation, a therapeutic experience, and something shifted. It's not like I had to dive into, you know, being in regular therapy at that point. I don't think that is how life has to go. Sometimes it's just like a little at a time. You know, that was a lot for me to take on board, that someone could care about something that I'd been through. So that was good for a while. And I just distracted myself, I think, by, you know, having some adventures in Europe for a while. But it started to catch up with me. I think after a while, it started to feel like I just felt lost still. And then I didn't know what I wanted to do next still. And I ended up coming home and getting a job, just getting a job waitressing. Someone that I met was talking about their therapist, and I started therapy at some point with an amazing therapist. And I guess I was ready then, and that totally changed my life.
That's so brilliant to hear that you got those positive experiences within the therapeutic environment. I can see how, when you didn't know what else to do, these incredible people that could emote in a way that you really connected to and were the first ones that, you know, were really able to help you put yourself first. It doesn't then surprise me hearing that seemed like, oh, I could do this for other people. And I guess maybe there's an element of then I get to support other people, which I know I'm good at.
I love the way you said that. It makes me think how important it is, just like an encounter with someone. A lot of people have said, oh, I had this conversation with a stranger, like I talked about things I've never talked about before. I've heard people say that kind of thing. And I think what happens in that moment is something a little bit like magic, I suppose, but it instills this feeling inside of you that there is this way of communicating, and you feel it, you sort of feel it in your body for the very first time, and I don't think you forget. So I think what happens, whether it's right away or down the road, it's something to draw on. You know, you had an encounter with someone that was relating in a different way from how you ever have had the chance to before. And you, a part of you just remembers and thinks, I want to do that again, or I want to have that experience again. So that may be why I took a chance on going to therapy for real. And why when I sat with my therapist, who was this open-minded, quirky, funny, irreverent guy, older guy, like I'd never met anyone like him before. He would let me talk about, and he would be open to talking about anything. And it was so exciting. I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I would love to do what he's doing for the rest of my life. I want to do what he's doing. But it, for some reason, that felt inaccessible to me. That felt like what you got to do if you were like a real grown-up or something like that. That just felt so not possible for me somehow.
I see what you mean. It's a role model for you, a role model it sounds like you really needed, but then also they're so far from maybe what you're used to that it can seem inaccessible. But I also want to highlight what you said about him being really funny, because I think that's a very common misconception that people think within the therapeutic environment, it's all doom and gloom. And actually, I laugh a lot with my therapist, and I think a lot of that comes down to the emotional release of it, you know, that you get to release all kinds of emotions. And sometimes things come up that are funny to you. You know, they may not be objectively funny, but sometimes I stumble across funny ways I've learned to think, or little sort of ironies in how my personality is formed. And it is quite funny.
I totally agree. I love that you told me that. Thank you. I was thinking the other day about how a new friend in my life was asking me about something in the past, and I started talking about it. It was, you know, a really traumatic experience. And I started laughing in telling it to her, because
right.
I always had to sort of tell it like I was telling a story in this sort of dissociative way, in a way. But I feel like I've even moved through that. I can actually see the absurdity of it. And to me, that even feels like part of my healing, is that I can feel it sometimes, how scary and frightening it was. But I can also, I have the ability to just kind of laugh at the absurdity that this is how adults were handling life when I was growing up. So yeah, I think that there's something about laughter that is kind of healing with another person.
And that's so interesting to me as well, as someone that gets to interview a lot of comedians, that I think you've really highlighted there the difference between potentially, if you're in that line of work, laughing at yourself versus laughing at funny things you've been through. Because
yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with Hannah Gadsby, but I'm a big fan of her. And in her Netflix special, she basically has a show where she considers leaving comedy. And a big part of that is she realized that many of her funniest jokes were built around trauma in her life. And in order to keep them funny, she had to keep them simple and fixed, and held back herself moving on from certain traumatic events because she needed them to be oversimplistic and funny for her comedy. Mm. And so you've really, without meaning it, highlighted the key for me there of the difference between the stuff where you're still in the trauma and the funny ends up being laughing at yourself, potentially, versus if you can work through it, you can laugh at the situation. You can have that emotional distance because you've worked through a lot of it.
Yeah, I just love the way you described that.
Good. I'm glad. Well, it's something I think about a lot, and particularly with something like having a mental health podcast, it's so important that I've always got to keep the pressure on myself as well of examining my ways of relating to things and not falling down any unhealthy traps of there is a world where somebody might think they're going to be a more interesting mental health podcaster if they are presenting symptoms in every episode. If they're really struggling, will that be a fascinating account of mental illness played out in front of the listener? And I think that's a really dangerous thing to even think about. And so I don't find myself going down that route, but I think it's important to be aware of it, you know, be honest about what I'm going through, but also be working on it, because I want to be not an example of struggle, but an example of how we can get through this and how to get help when you need help. That's the example I should be.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? Because then you are working on your own evolution and your own healing. And I think so much about that's what's happening between people in conversation, is that we're showing other people what healing looks like. So when you're working on it and you're talking about it out loud, you're letting people into what it's like to be you working on your healing. I feel like what we're doing then is we're saying, this is what it looks like. This is what my process looks like. Yeah. And I think the openness, a bit of openness about that, not to the degree that you feel overly vulnerable. I'm just going to pause for a minute and say that one of my favorite things that I learned was from Brené Brown. I don't know if you know, when the thing where she was talking about how she will talk about really painful things she's gone through, but only if she's mostly recovered and healed from them, not if it's very raw and vulnerable still. I think about that a lot in terms of like what it's to me, that's a boundary thing. Just for me, my own boundaries. I protect myself if I'm still feeling too vulnerable, but I don't have a problem talking about things that I don't feel that much shame about anymore, but that I still struggle with. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if that's what you were.
No, I think that's a really good point. And that really brings in the importance of therapy as that one environment where you get to just put things out of like, here are five things that I don't know what to do with. Help. And that is really powerful.
And that's huge. I feel like that is so much of it for people, is moving it out of the category of shame and out into the open. Like, it's okay that I'm struggling. Actually, everyone's got things, feelings, experiences that are kind of unresolved, probably, that still hurt sometimes. But if you're carrying around those things and thinking you can't talk about them because they're kind of shameful, that feel like that just perpetuates the woundedness we feel. And that part of healing is at least moving it out of an area where we feel there's shame to be hurting. I think that might have been maybe one of the bigger things I was trying to figure out when I left home, was like, am I supposed to feel shame because of the fact that I'm hurting? And I just wanted to stop feeling that hurting was a shameful thing.
For sure. That's massive.
So that's why I talk about it.
No, and that's what you've got to do. You've got to quash that. And sometimes it is as simple as practicing that, right? You know, I've got this environment where I get to talk about mental health every week. And so there's rarely a situation it feels inappropriate for me now. But it's partly because I'm so used to it. You know, it's generally other people that signal that maybe they're not ready to talk about certain things. And I can respect that. But I don't have the internal filter of I've got to shut everything down and then see if it's acceptable. You know, a lot of that reflex has gone for me. And I think I'm much better for it.
That's incredible. That's huge. Wow.
And I'm interested then, as we start to move towards wrapping up, to get an idea of you then going on to become a counsellor yourself. And what was the experience like from the other side of it, going through not only the introspection around training in that profession, but then going into the room and helping somebody, but also keeping the boundaries and not allowing yourself to maybe get into a dynamic where you see yourself as that person's only help, or that their issues are all your responsibility?
Oh my gosh, such a great question, Bobby. I have so many thoughts on that too. Because of course, going back to school, which I did in my late 30s, I was writing. I was writing tons and I wanted to be a writer. And I just knew I wasn't going to make it as a single mom that I was at that point with a fantasy writing career. And so I just thought, well, you know, therapy is almost like story. it's just not my story. It's getting to hear other people's stories. And so I thought that seemed like a good job for me. So I finally got to that point of, you know, having the dream job like my first therapist did. Went back to school and got all the training and left school. And those questions that you, those things that you just mentioned about boundaries, and I brought those forward with me. In the beginning, I think that question of thinking you're the only person that can help someone, I feel like that is something that I notice is probably very, very common with therapists, actually. I think that therapists were probably children that grew up being really good at helping people with their emotions. And so that's a super strong skill they have. So it's easy to translate that into, you know, their occupation. And I remember feeling that in the beginning of my practice, like, you know, you need people to come to see you. So you're thinking, oh, I can help everybody with everything, you know, just I'm open for business. People, please come to me. But I started to realize that that wasn't true. I started seeing clients and I realized that not only am I not good with absolutely every topic or struggle that people would come to therapy for, I wanted to help people find the exact help they needed. And so I also wanted to be able to be partly myself in therapy as well. And to do that best, I started to think about what areas I was really good at and what I liked working with and the client, you know, sort of demographic that I worked best with. And I realized that I could do both. I could be me and be a therapist and work with people that we were a good fit together. I am a big fan of bringing some of yourself to the work of being a therapist so that people have a chance to connect. Yeah, I think being a therapist is a great way to continue to be a real person and also practice the great boundaries you needed as a kid, which is, it's not my job to fix this person. It's my job to be present for this person. They get to do the therapeutic work themselves. It's their personal, you know, journey.
I mean, that's so key. We have to pause on that because it can confuse people, because it can be very easy to go into that environment and think, okay, I'm here to see this person, they're going to help. And if we lean too far into that, that can be very disempowering, because ultimately what you want as a therapist is absolutely to support somebody, but to support them to leave you one day. You know, right. you bring them in, you help them build the tools for themselves.
Exactly.
I've had a friend describe it to me before as it's almost like parenting finishing school. You know, you kind of go to not get a new parent, but to learn the bits of how to look after yourself that we have to learn for ourselves.
Right. And someone who wants you to be able to understand from yourself what you need, not to look to other people. It sort of feels like that is my job, is to get people to trust themselves again. Ultimately, yes, to trust yourself. I feel like that's my main job, to trust yourself and what you need.
That's massive. And, you know, for some people, it's making that first step. Going to see you is such a big deal. And then you are there to empower them to find all the other things they need, because sometimes people can be in that way, that they really are so used to looking after other people or pushing down their emotions or whatever their thing is, that we can be very disconnected with what we actually need to do next. And so I think it's so powerful, the profession and what you do personally. And I also love what you said about learning to bring yourself to the work as well, that difficult balance, because you need to have the boundaries. You're trying to find a way of bringing some of these skills that you've learned of supporting people, but not doing it in a way where you replicate parts of your past. You know, it's not your responsibility to be the only person that can ever help them. They've got to learn to help themselves. They've got to learn to communicate maybe with other people that they might be struggling communicating with, and build a whole network of support. But then also, there's the element of you've still got to be a real person. We can forget that it's a relationship. And so if you're coming like that first therapist you described, and you're very shut down, it's going to be really difficult for somebody to build a familiarity, a connection to you, in order to feel safe sharing some of the things they may have never told anybody.
Yeah, that's a great way of describing it.
This is where it helps not being in the therapy profession myself. Sometimes when you're in it, it can be, I think, so all-encompassing, it's difficult to even put into words. Whereas I get to be a user and tell you, I guess, how I relate to it as a layperson.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear about that from another person who's talking about just therapy, the experience in general. It's so good to hear how important it is.
It is, and for so many people. And so if people are connecting with what you've shared so far, are there any messages you'd want to share in terms of why you think they should go to therapy? And then after that, maybe why they should buy your book as well.
I think if you just feel like you need to share the weight of some of the things that you've gone through or that you're currently struggling with, that's a good reason to go to therapy. And I think looking for therapists, trying a therapist out, and if you feel like it's not the right fit, if it's possible to try for someone else, I think that's an amazing first step of recognizing what you need and what's important. You have a right to find someone you click with. That's an example of how your future relationship should be like. You are allowed to have relationships with people that you feel good with, that you click with, is a great first chance to prioritize that need that you have to feel understood and validated.
I think that's great. And I think one thing I would add to that is not to do what I think I did a little bit when choosing the person that I go to, which is you don't need to overanalyze it. You know, if you have in your mind that you maybe want to go to a particular gender, somebody from a particular background, someone, you know, maybe you want to go to someone locally, maybe you're like, actually, I'm terrified of meeting them in the supermarket. I'd rather go to someone near my workplace rather than my home. Whatever it is for you, I think that rationale is fine. You know, I'd rather somebody just goes with that and gets the therapy than talks themselves out because they're like, oh, but is that judgmental that I think I want a woman over a man or a man over a woman?
I think I agree 100%, Bobby, because that's another example that you just described of starting to value how you feel. It doesn't matter. It's just how you feel. It's okay to give value to that. Like, I just want someone who lives in the other town. That's moving out of the old ways that we felt like we had to, you know, rationalize what we felt and just valuing it. This just happens to be how I feel. I'm going to trust that. So I love your description of how you look for a therapist.
I think it's so important. And if it is a big deal, you know, if there is something there to be dug into, you can dig into that with them anyway. Because I've done that with mine. You know, a big thing for me was, I don't know if I've shared this on the podcast before, a big thing for me was choosing someone that had come from another minority background like mine, who could do the living between two cultures without me having to explain it. And I'm sure many, many counsellors can relate to that, even if they've not gone through that. But for me, that was a big deal. And I decided, that's fine. This is somebody where, when I was looking through the profiles, I thought, this looks like somebody that I can feel comfortable with. And I've been comfortable with a lot of similar people in the past. So my counsellor's Jamaican, and I'd grown up around a lot of diversity, around a lot of caring Black women, you know, whether that's within schooling environments, whether that's within like friends of my family, whether that's friends that I grew up with. And I remember talking to her about it because I thought, is this weird, you know? But then she said to me, she kind of laughed at it and she said, well, I'd much rather you choose me because of my background than you don't choose me because of it. And I was like, oh, that's a nice way of looking at it.
Yeah, definitely. I love that. It sounds like a great relationship, a great fit for you. Yeah, you have to start out with feeling like you're going to be able to trust and, you know, feel safe and with this person. So we're kind of drawing on all the information we have in our histories, you know, that we're conscious of or unconscious with, and it's worth valuing some of those things you have an instinct for.
For sure. And so if anyone's having an instinct to learn more about you and maybe buy your upcoming book, could you share a bit about that?
Well, so yes, my book just came out January 12th. And it's named after my Instagram account, Notes from Your Therapist. And the book was a result of starting that Instagram account as just a kind of creative experiment, just maybe another example in my life of getting to talk about things I wasn't sure it was okay to talk about. And apparently, a lot of people have the same feeling. So,
what is it? 330,000 people following you now?
I guess so. Yes, it really, it surprises me still. But
just for context for our listeners then, so I'll share, it's an account where you write these little notes and they're often these just really succinct thoughts on mental health or on life, and they're very quotable. And so it's something that I think a lot of people see that, and even whether they're in therapy or not, there's something to be gained from the wonderful succinct way of explaining things that I think you have to become good at in your profession.
Wow, thank you, Bobby. I feel like that is the perfect place for me to merge my personal self and the journey that I'm on, and also kind of feel that I get to be a sort of healing presence in the world, which I think we all have the potential to be. And I guess I feel like it's just about being open about pain and things we've struggled through, and just being kind of a lifeline for other people, because that's what I've needed, is for other people to be real.
And that's what people connect with, right? You know, we all somehow growing up with this idea of wanting to be perfect, and we forget that that's entirely unrelatable. That's not an easy way to connect with people. And also, perfection doesn't exist anyway.
No, it's such a weapon, I think, being expected to be perfect from adults when you're a kid. You know you can't do that. And then I think it just kind of, it disconnects us, I think, in our future relationships. If we think we're supposed to be perfect and other people are supposed to be perfect, how can you have, you know, close, intimate relationships if it's all about being perfect?
Yeah, because ultimately you're playing pretend. You're trying to do this thing that isn't real. And so if people want to find your book, I'm assuming they can find it online bookstores. I will find a link to put in the episode description. Anything else you want to plug before we go?
I don't think so. Thank you so much, Bobby. Such a pleasure to be on your show.
You're very welcome. No, it's been so lovely chatting to you. I get the feeling we could chat all day very easily.
Probably. That's super easy for me too. We definitely could.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.